This is Kat Cho, author of Wicked Fox.
And I'm Clarabelle Ortega, author of Ghost Squad, and this is Write or Die.
Do I sound different?
You do.
Ooh, okay, good. I don't know why my computer is being a butthole.
Everybody's computer is being buttholes today, and...
It's butthole day.
It's butthole day. It's officially butthole day. September 4th is butthole day. Beyonce's birthday is butthole day.
So, we have, like... podcast checklist now.
Yeah, we definitely do. And before we get to any of that, I just really want to talk about the Patreon really quick, because Kat and I really did not expect to get as many patrons as we did, as quickly as we did. And as we're recording this right now, on this day of Beyonce's birth, September 4th, 2019, we have 24 patrons, and we just launched this 5 days ago.
Yeah, I mean, it went live and we didn't talk about it for like a week and then we tweeted about it on like Monday, so yeah, like 3 or 4 days ago.
Yeah, and just thank you everyone, it's been really nice. One of the worst parts about being a creative who was not also born wealthy, a la Paris Hilton, is that you have to constantly sort of struggle between, like, do I have money and insurance, or do I make things? Because sometimes the two things sort of, like, clash. I've been feeling that a lot lately. I feel like you have as well, Kat. And things like the Patreon really, really help to make us be able to do the things that we love to do and that people like to listen to, but also not go completely broke. So it's just really super appreciated.
Yeah. And the thing is that, you know, we're not even talking about any type of money at this point that will be help us live at all. It's the fact that creating a podcast and creating a lot of creative things costs money and of themselves. So it's not like we can just make a podcast for free baseline. Like, we have to pay for hosting. We have to pay for, you know, memberships to things. Like, even to record the episodes, there's a membership we have to sign up, and that costs money as well, just to have that app on our computers. So, you know, it's really great to gain the support, because at the end of the day, all we were hoping from the Patreon was to allow us to continue to bring you guys the podcast. And the fact that that's doable is so amazing and so wonderful. And we really, really appreciate your support. And we just think that it's really great to know that we have this community behind us. It makes us feel like really honored and happy.
Yeah, we're really super happy and just appreciative of everybody who's signed up so far. And for the people who haven't, you know, if you can't afford it, we still love you just as much. We don't want anybody to stretch themselves thin and don't think that you're not an important listener if you're not part of the Patreon, because, you know, not everybody has extra coins to spare every month, and we completely get that. But the support from everyone, from like retweets and sharing, it's just been really great, and we're really happy, and it's definitely a needed boost right now.
You know, as we record this, we're going into fall, which is kind of the last big active season of publishing of the year. And it's weird because, you know, it's not like everything is over when the year is over, but I think like when you think about your successes, you think of it in time frames, right? You think of it as like, what did I accomplish this year? So it definitely feels a little weird when you go into fall as a publishing professional or as an author, because it's like the final stretch to accomplish things.
Yeah.
And it puts a weird amount of pressure on you, yeah. which I don't think people really do talk about a lot. It's hard to, because again, it's not like this is the end or anything like that, but in this industry, a lot of reports come out at the end of the year. The best ofs lists come out, fiscal reports come out. And so we get a lot more data than you might think. It's very overwhelming. And it's hard. It is. It's hard because like all of this stuff that you put your heart and soul into is boiled down to like one number pretty much. And it's hard to see sometimes.
Yeah, and I think that with things like this podcast, it puts a little bit more control in our hands. Like, we do everything. Like, absolutely everything that happens with Ride or Die is up to me and Kat. So even, like, whatever results we get from it, like, it's so nice because we put all the effort. We can see all the stats, and that's, like, completely opposite to how publishing works. So it's, like, a nice, like, sort of buffer to have this to sort of counteract all of those, like, end-of-year blues when you don't feel like you accomplished as much as you would like to. I feel like what we have built with Ride or Die is really important and a big accomplishment. And I feel proud of us and proud of this community too. So I think that's something that we should definitely focus on and think about and not give too much sort of credence to those lists, because who gives a shit?
Yeah. It's hard. It is hard. And, you know, we talk a lot about mental health in this podcast. And I think part of it is because both Claribel and I struggle with certain mental health issues. And being a creative doesn't really help those situations. Being a person of color doesn't help those situations. And being unable to pay bills sometimes does not help those situations.
Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, it is kind of like we've made a bunch of decisions in our lives that exacerbates mental health issues. But I would say on the other side of the coin is that, like, we've both tried living the other way, having a 9-to-5, having like that regular non-creative job. And it's not doable, but I will say that I kind of feel like I wouldn't feel the amount of joy that I do feel if I wasn't writing. So it's worth it, but, you know, it's hard to get through those stretches of those down stretches, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I'm still working 9-to-5.
Oh, yeah.
And writing, which is like, we were just talking like before we started recording, I just told Kat, like, just a heads up, I'm super depressed tonight. And it was like, you know, it can be one of those things where it's just like, you know, just my normal depression, just being a jerk. So it's been hard. And I went to the gym today, even though like I really didn't feel like it. And I had a panic attack during personal training. It's just been a hard day today. But like seeing, I keep bringing this up, but just like seeing the support from the community has really bolstered me and helped me like feel like I should keep going, because I have a lot to offer and to give. And like, I think sometimes we sell ourselves short, right? Because we didn't think we were even gonna get any patrons, let alone so many in such a short amount of time. And like, we were setting goals to unlock like the bonus query podcast, and I was like, let's do it at 30, because I really want to do the podcast and I feel like it's gonna take us forever. We're literally already almost there.
Oh, and talking about our patrons, let's get into some of that checklist, because I've got a shout out.
Woo!
If you are one of our Patreon patrons at $10, giving $10 or more a month, then we will give you a personalized shout out on the podcast by whatever name you would like us to call you. So if you want us to call you Mr. Pooty Potty, then we will call you Mr. Pooty Potty on the podcast.
But just not like any slurs or weird shit like that.
Oh, yeah.
We will not say that.
We will not say anything that's insensitive, inappropriate. I mean, we curse on the podcast, but like in general.
Yeah.
We would love to give a huge shout out to Anne-Marie. Thank you so much, Anne-Marie, for being one of our patrons and for supporting the podcast. We really appreciate you, and we hope
we
that...
We love you.
That's your special song from Claribel. But yeah,
we love you, Anne-Marie.
I keep on trying to say, like, serious things, and Claribel keeps on saying...
Anne-Marie is so beautiful. Sorry.
Am I? Oh my gosh.
All right, go.
Anyway, yeah, thank you, Anne-Marie. We adore you.
We love you. You're the best. We have some questions, too, from our patrons. It's another really cool thing. If you sign up at just the $1 tier, $1, then you get to ask us anything, and we will answer it on the podcast. That's pretty cool. That makes you kind of famous
Right? As of right now, we're going to probably answer every single one because we're getting like enough that we can we have time to answer all of them.
Yeah.
If there's ever a time where we're getting so many questions that we just don't have time to answer them on the podcast, then we'll pick some to answer on the podcast, but the other ones we will answer within the Patreon feed. So you will get your question answered, and we're just like letting you know ahead of time, like not thinking that we're like the coolest people in the world. We're going to get so many questions. But if it happens, like just in case we want to be prepared. We don't want to be promising anything that we can't deliver. That's our number one thing with this Patreon, is that it was very hard for us to start because we were like, we need to make sure that like the people who are supporting us are getting something that's worthwhile for them.
Yeah, and we had full on debates about things. Like, yeah. We were really, really careful about the things that we picked. And there's still going to be more stuff that we probably add in the future as we figure things out. But yeah, we want to make sure everybody gets value. But let's stop talking about Patreon so much.
Well, okay, here's the first question. Ready?
Mm.
Okay. My question is, how many passes do you do per revision round? For me, I do a minimum of 2 and a maximum of 5 before I give a new number to my current draft. So I think what they're saying is like, I think I do this too, is I number my drafts like version 1, version 2, version 3.
Mm.
So I think that's what they mean before they move on to a new version.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the book for me. It really does. For Ghost Squad, I wrote about 3 drafts before the final one. For my YA before that. Okay, keep in mind, I started that book in 2014 and I finished revising it for that time in 2017, I think, or 2018. I don't know. It was probably at least 10 drafts for that one. I think it all depends on the book. For me personally, I think some books you draft clean and don't have to revise as much.
Mm-hmm.
And other books take a lot of revisions. I don't think there's any magic number. Personally, I think that you revise until you feel like there's nothing that you can do to make the book better.
Yeah, I agree. I did this thing where every time I revised it, what I felt was a significant amount of revision, I would give it a new date. I would be like, oh, this is, you know, Wicked Fox 2, September 9th, 2019. And when I was doing that, I actually was looking through an old folder of old versions of Wicked Fox, the original manuscript. And I had dozens and dozens of different dated documents. And I would never be able to tell you which of those dates correlated to like which version. I was very paranoid that I would lose changes. I realize now, with being calmer, that I don't give it a new version number unless that's a version that I'm turning into somebody else, like other eyes are seeing it. So like if I turn it into my agent or even my critique partners or my editor, then I send them version 1, and then all the revisions I do after that, after the one I sent them, is now the new version 2.
That's really smart. That's so smart.
Because like that's a set action that like I cannot deny that means something. It means that I thought it was good enough for other people to read it. The only other time that I will give it a new version number, if it's not that I sent it to somebody, is if I get like a huge brainstorm where I'm literally changing a whole plot line, which I do a lot actually, or I'm like deleting a character. And so oftentimes I will say go from version 1 to version 2, and then I'll just put in parentheses, version 1 parentheses, this is the one with the flashback like storyline, so that I know that, oh, that's what I took out of it to make version 2. But yeah, in terms of like how many revisions I do before I go on to a new version, it varies greatly. Like sometimes it's 1 revision pass and sometimes it's 10. I don't think there's a set number. And I think that no one should try to create a formula, because I don't think that that's how it works in this field, because it is such a creative field.
Yeah, it's definitely different for everybody. There's people who, like Mike, one of my best writing friends ever, he wrote Planetside and Spaceside. You guys should go pick it up. He writes really clean first drafts because like he's amazing, like technical, like he's just really good at reading his own stuff back, reading other people's stuff back. So he can write things and make them, well, I don't know about first draft, but he can write things really cleanly just as a skill from like when he started, you know, and not everybody has that. It's some people excel at other things. And like, I feel like it's both in the kind of writer that you are and the book, because each book really is a different writing process. So that's my advice. Just don't, and Kat's advice too, because you said the same exact thing as me. Don't try to make it like a formula. Like,
yeah, just, Claire Hill speaks for me.
Yeah, I speak for Kat. All questions should be directed to my office. Don't try to make a formula. It's never going to work. Just, you know, write and revise until the book is really, really the best that it can be. And do not rush. I feel like a lot of times when people ask, like, how many should I do? They're getting ready for something like TV Pit or Pit Mad. And they're like, well, I did 3 revisions, so now I'm ready. And it's like, but are you really? Is the book still giving you questions? Like, when you think about the book, is there something nagging you about it? Is there something bothering you about it? That little voice in your head. You really know if it's ready or not. You just have to be honest with yourself. Mm-hmm. And you have to be patient with yourself and your writing process. Especially if it's your first book. Because if it's your first book, you are learning how to write books for the first time. And you need to allow yourself the time to figure that process out.
All right, the next question is probably an easier, quicker answer. What's a backlist title that you like to recommend, wish more people would check out?
Can I give 2?
Yeah, this is our podcast. Right. We can do what we want.
Do what we want. We make the rules. Don't sue us, Taylor Swift. So one of them is a young adult, which I talked about on Twitter the other day, and everybody was like, what is this book? Like, half of the people were like, what is this book? And the other half of people were like, yes, I love this book. And it is the Jacoby series by William Ritter. Described as Buffy meets Sherlock Holmes. It is so good. It's really funny. One of my favorite series ever. And then the other one is a middle grade that I talk about all the time. And it's actually still ongoing, but the first book came out a little while ago, and that's Nevermore by Jessica Townsend. If you have not read this series, then please go read it. Read the whole, like, all of the books that are out, and then come back and listen to the rest of the podcast. Please. I am begging you. I love it. Okay. You can go.
Okay. Mine is Serpentine by Cindy Pond. Which honestly, if I am remembering correctly, is probably one of the first, if not the first, Asian YA fantasies published by a YA author. It's so good, you guys. Like
Own Voices, basically. Own Voices.
Yeah, Own Voices. I mean, Own Voices, what Own Voices is intended to be. But, oh my god, it's so good. Not just the world building. So it's set in, like, what is, like, an ancient China with fantasy elements where gods and demons are real, but the characters are so good. Their relationships are really complicated. There were certain things where I was like, oh, this is who's going to fall in love with this person, and like, these people are going to be enemies, and these, no, I was wrong, because Cindy Pond, like, made characters who messed up a lot and, like, changed a lot. And so I wasn't able to predict what they were going to do, because they legitimately went on, like, a character arc journey that was really satisfying by the end. It's a duology, so it was really satisfying by the end. I love, love, love this duology. I mean, I think that there could be more books in the series, honestly, because there's so much more I want to know about this world. And then if I was going to suggest a middle grade, I would suggest Spirit Hunters by Ellen Oh, another amazing Asian speculative book. This one's like middle grade horror. And the interesting thing is that, like, I actually think middle grade horror that I've read has often been much more terrifying than young adult or even adult horror. And I think it's because it plays off of, like, your most, like, childlike fears.
Yep.
Like, that you had when you were, like, 10 years old and will never leave you. And it, like, makes you feel really vulnerable. But I think what Ellen Oh does really well is that she also plays off of the horror with moments of levity and humor. So she kind of, like, lulls you into a complacency, and then she's like, something terrifying! And then you're like, oh no! I forgot that this was a scary book!
Yeah, that sounds really creepy.
Yeah.
And, like, my jam.
It's so good. And I just love her middle grade writing. She has a new one coming out that I'm super, super obsessed with already, which is, like, The Dragon Egg Princess, which is also, like, Korean fantasy. Yeah, I'm really excited about that one. Anyway, so those are my picks.
Yay, we love Cindy. Yeah. She's mom.
And Ellen.
Yes. I love both of them. I remember I saw them at a show and they were talking to each other and it was just like an orb of magic around them.
Yeah, they're amazing. Okay, so then our final question that we have for now is, have you guys ever had moments where you feel like there's no progress in your works in progress, no matter how many words you add? I feel like I really want to say who asked this, but I won't because we, as of now, have promised anonymity. But I feel like this is such a drag. We're being
dragged. Yes, absolutely. I think I feel that right now. Even though I wrote a buttload during August, I didn't hit my goal. So because I didn't hit my goal, I feel like I haven't written enough. And now I really want to finish. But I'm in that like point where I'm like resisting the work, even though it's all I want to do. It's just a really frustrating place to be. And I think that's adding to my anxiety. But absolutely, I feel like that constantly.
I'm a pantser. And so for me, I write like not really knowing necessarily what's going to happen next. Like I know in general where I want to end up, but I write by the seat of my pants. So sometimes I'll write like a whole entire book or like most of a book and before I realize that it's just not working and that there's like huge plot holes that I can't recover from. And that's sucks. The fact that I have to go back and literally rewrite the whole entire book that I just wrote, it really sucks. But I will say that like as time has gone on, I value even in those moments because who was it that said this? They said it on Twitter. They said it to us on Twitter that like even the books that don't get you like a book deal or don't get you an agent is worthwhile because it makes you a better writer.
Yep, absolutely. So true.
And now that I'm further into my career and my writing process, I can actually see it happening. Like I can actually notice that I'm better now than I was 2 years ago. And I can notice when I'm better from draft to draft too. And it's gratifying in and of itself. Like it sucks getting there, but when you're there and you're looking back, you're almost like, ah, look at all the proof I have that I was horrible at writing this story and I'm better now.
Absolutely. And I feel that, especially right now with Witchbirds. Like, I can definitely tell you that it's the best that I've written so far. And Witchlings felt like that too. It just felt a lot more natural. It felt like I knew what I was doing. It felt like I knew my process. I knew what I wanted to do. And at one point, because I started Witchbirds a while ago. Mm-hmm. But when I picked it back up, suddenly I was a different writer and things just, it changed. The voice changed. Things came a lot smoother for me. And that's all a result of, you know, me learning and like letting myself have that time in the writing process and letting myself suck. And I think that's why I'm a little stuck right now, actually, because I am also a pantser and I have a general overall idea always of the plot, but I don't have scene by scene outlines or anything like that at all. I have like a query type situation at most, sometimes a synopsis, but for me there's a lot of different like moving parts with this book because there's like political intrigue involved and that gets really sticky. So the plot right now is like I'm trying to untangle it instead of just writing and letting it happen and then untangling it when I go back to revisions, basically, which, you know, I just figured out why I can't keep writing right now, so that's great. Thank you, podcast. But yeah, absolutely, I feel that constantly. I feel like all of us do at one point or another. At a certain point, you just have to sort of sit down and keep writing, and it does get done. It can feel like a sludge, but if you chip away at it, one day you're gonna look at your word count and you're gonna be like, holy crap, I can't believe I wrote this much. So you just have to keep going.
Yeah, I have like a document of like deleted scenes because if I delete something, I still want to be able to cannibalize it maybe for future things. Yeah. And by the time I finish writing a book so that it's good enough to be sent to other eyes, my deleted scenes document is actually longer than my actual manuscript. But that's also because I'm a pantser. To be fair. So like, don't think that you're a failure if your deleted scenes document is small. But
yeah,
for me personally, I delete so many words in the drafting process that I can make like two other books out of it.
Holy moly. That's a lot.
And I will say, this is, I'm not going to get too into it because we're taking a lot of time with this, but I actually literally just, I have a blog with some of Clarabelle and my critique partners. It's called the Writer's Block Party blog. And we have a roundtable post where it's pretty much like where we go around and like four or five of us answer questions about a topic. And one of it's about burnout. And it's applicable here because I do think that if you're writing and writing and writing and nothing is sticking and you literally can't find anything worthwhile in what you're writing. Like I'm saying, like, even a sentence, like a sentence that you're like, this sentence is pretty good. Everything else is crap, but at least I like the sentence. If you can't even say that, then it is potentially an alert that you could be burning out. And I think in that moment, it's worthwhile for you to just kind of take a step back. Like, you know, if, especially if you're not on strict deadline, because self-care is really important within the writing process. And, you know, oftentimes we do end up pushing ourselves to the brink of breaking because we think, just get to this point, just get to this point. And that's really unhealthy. And Clarabelle and I have talked about that before as well, but I'm not, you know, check out the roundtable because I do talk about it in more detail in that one. But
yeah, and we will add that to the show notes as well.
Yeah.
So if you guys want to support us and you are listening to the podcast and loving it, you can do so by subscribing to Write or Die. You can leave us a review. iTunes is the best for us because it helps other listeners find us. Also, you can pick up our books. Kat's book is Wicked Fox and it is out now and you can buy it everywhere. Buy 20 copies for your friends and family. My book Ghost Squad comes out April 7th, 2020, but you can pre-order it at buyghostsquad.com. And then my graphic novel Rizos is on Goodreads and you can add that at rizosgraphicnovel.com. We also have ads now. If you want to promote your book or your business, publishers, agents, authors, companies of all shapes and sizes, whoever you are, if you want to reach over 50,000 listeners in the book community, you can buy ad space on Write or Die now, and me and Kat will read the ads for you. It will be an amazing way to gain exposure for yourself or your company. Just email us at writerdiepodcast@gmail.com for our pricing. And lastly, we talked about this a lot in the beginning, but if you want to support us on Patreon, our Patreon page is patreon.com/writerdiepodcast. We would really appreciate if you signed up. If each of me and Kat's followers signed up for Patreon, we would have thousands of patrons. So...
yeah.
Thousands. So each of you, just help us out.
Even the bots. I'm looking at you, bots.
Yeah,
bots. Following me on Twitter.
Just come on.
Gain sentience and follow our Patreon. And for the ads, for a limited time only, if you want me to, I will record your ad in a weird voice. it might not be a good voice, but it'll be weird. And that's
pending review by the Write or Die board. We didn't discuss this.
I'm going rogue.
And the final thing that I wanted to talk about is Write or Die. We are trying to branch out to interview all kinds of writers. So screenwriters, playwrights, video game writers. If you write any sort of screenplays for, you know, TV, movies, anything like that, we want to interview you. So if you'd like to be on the show and you have some credits, you've actually had stuff, you know, turned into like a movie or a pilot, then you can email us at writerdiepodcast@gmail.com.
Our guest today is Axie Oh, a first-generation Korean-American born in New York City and raised in New Jersey. Oh, this bio is already a lie because she was also raised in Las Vegas. She studied Korean history and creative writing as an undergrad at the University of California, San Diego, and holds an MFA from Lesley University in writing for young people. Her passions include K-pop, anime, stationery supplies, and milk tea. She currently resides in Las Vegas, Nevada with her puppy, Toro. And another addendum to this bio is that her favorite cousin is me, because she is my cousin.
Hopefully none of our other cousins also listen to this.
I'm going to send it to them.
Like, honestly, if our cousins listen to this podcast, then please chat me in the cousins chat to let me know.
And also support our Patreon.
Oh, yeah. And support our Patreon. I'm looking specifically at you, Jim. Okay. Sorry. This intro got way too long. How are you doing, Axie?
Good.
What was that? I have so many bloopers. I can't.
just the intro itself. I was like, is she expecting me to edit this? I'm going to leave it just like you did it.
So as you know, Axie, because I expect you to listen to every single episode as soon as it airs, this podcast is about the struggle bus that is publishing. And you and I struggled together, kind of, partly because I forced you to help me, with my writing. So yeah, give all the listeners kind of like the quick rundown of like why you got into writing, why you like writing what you write, and like how you got your agent, and then how you got your first book deal.
So when I was born, I'm just kidding. I was always a big reader. Growing up, I read a lot of books. I definitely
not newspapers.
Lots of newspapers. And then, but I actually didn't write until college. The first time I ever wrote anything creatively was my college essay in high school. And I wrote, just, you know, to get into college, right? You write a creative essay. I wrote a creative essay and I showed it to my English teacher at the time. And my English teacher told me that I should be a creative writer. Like I should study creative writing in college. And I was like, okay. So when I went to undergrad at UCSD, I studied writing, creative writing and history. So I was actually a double major. I was a creative writing and history major. And my professors in undergrad are actually also the ones who told me that I should try to write a book. Because they read my work and they were like, you should write fiction. And I was like, okay. And so the first book I ever wrote was after college in 2012, which Kat read.
I read it at work.
Yes. And then, so that was the first book I ever wrote was in 2012. And I queried 5 people who I knew would reject it because I didn't want real feedback. I wanted people to be like, it sucks. And that me'd be like, all right, yes, I knew that. And then in 2013, I wrote what is now my debut, Rebel Soul, but it wasn't Rebel Soul at the time. The reason I wrote it was because I was really into Korean history and, you know, Korean dramas and K-pop and all that good jazz. And I wanted to write a book that actually dealt a lot with the liberation movement in Korean history, but not historical. I want it to be like a fun sci-fi novel. And then I queried it and I got lots of rejections.
How dare they?
Yeah, this is 2013.
But the reason you got rejections was because even though it had heavy sci-fi elements, it was during that time when like, if something even smelled a bit like dystopia, it was auto-rejected by people. And, like, they were like, oh, dystopia just doesn't sell anymore. And it was, like, so frustrating, I remember, because we were talking about it. And you're like, I didn't mean to write a dystopian novel. I just wrote, like, a futuristic sci-fi world with, like, giant robots. And, like, we were both so annoyed, I remember, because we were like, you guys have no, like, you have no vision.
Yeah, so, and then that 2014, and Kat was in town. I feel like you're just always in town when things happen. You're just around, even though we'd never live together.
Yeah, we live on literal separate coasts.
Yeah, so Kat was in town, and the ALA was in Las Vegas that year, and we went, and someone at the Lee and Lowe booth gave me a flyer for their New Visions Award, and so I was like, oh, this award sounds really awesome. So I applied in 2014 and then they did like the semifinals, which are like 6 people. And then they chose the winner in 2015 and I was the winner, which
Yay!
And so this award is pretty much anyone who's unagented, unpublished author of color can apply. And if you win, they publish your book. And then I got my agent in this following fall, 2015, who is Patricia Nelson, and she's awesome. I queried her with a different book, and she has represented me ever since. So
yeah, I kind of love that your journey is non-traditional.
Yeah.
I feel like sometimes people are like, these are the rules, and this is what's set forth by blogs and the interwebs. And if I don't do this, then I'm never going to achieve my goals. But the lesson that I've always learned about publishing, if I've learned anything, is that there's no set rubric or rules, which is super frustrating, but also very.
Yeah.
So once you signed with your agent, what was next?
What was next? Revising that book. Also, man, my timeline is getting all confused right now. Okay, because The Rebel Soul came out in 2017. And then right after it came out is when two books came to me and said, can you pitch us another book in the same world? And I was really excited about that because when I was writing Rebel Soul, I kind of had characters that I was like, oh, I want to write their story. Also, that's like a thing I do in general. I will always have like something in the book that could be a potential next story just for myself. Like I did that with even Rogue Heart. There's like, I left like a little thing at the end where I was like,
because, oh my God.
Because it's just more, it's just fun for me to do. Not like, you know, not that it'll become anything, but they came to me, my publisher came to me and said, can you pitch us another book in the same world? And so I worked on the proposal for that. I sent it to Kat and others. And then they bought it, which was really cool. And so Rogue Heart comes out in October. Yay.
And I think by the time this episode's out, Rogue Heart will be out. So yes. You can buy it on most online retailers like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, things like that. So definitely go get that. And also it's a companion novel, right, Axie? So yeah. You can read it if you haven't read Rebel Soul.
Yeah.
We'll put the links in the show notes as well so everybody can buy 20 copies. You're required to do
our
so.
Our minimum our minimum of copies that people have to buy of our books is 20.
Yes.
So, oh.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's I just like, have to buy 5 more of your books is what you're saying.
Yes. That is what I'm saying.
To reach the minimum.
Yeah. So I actually remember that in the middle of all this, like the standard steps of, you know, getting your book deal and getting your agent, you also went on submission with the agent with a completely different manuscript, and you applied to an MFA program, and you went to the MFA program. And during all of this, you also had like books under contract. And I think that it's really interesting because a lot of people imagine doing all of these things and you did it all at the same time. So you have a really good perspective on time management and choosing which projects to work on. So do you mind just kind of talking about that a little bit in that process?
Yeah. So I actually got into grad school at the same time that the winner of it was announced that I won the New Visions Award. So it was interesting because I got to grad school and they're like, what are you doing here? And I was like, well, you know, I didn't, you know, go to grad school to get published. I went to grad school to improve my craft. And as I was talking before, I really thrive under mentorship of others. That's where I feel like I learn and I write stronger writing when I have mentors and people guiding me and people telling me I suck actually helps. Or not I suck, but people being very critical of me really helps me because I think, Clairebelle, you said this in a different podcast, but you were saying like how you can be stubborn when people are critical of you. You're like, I'm the greatest. I'm like that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
which is a good thing, but it's also like I sometimes like people telling me, no, you need to do all this stuff because it's a challenge for me and it makes me feel like, good, I want to. Once I, you know, if they tell me I need to work on characterization, once I get it down, I'm like, I won. I conquered that. So I like to work in an environment where people are challenging me. In general, I like to work in chaos. So actually it makes sense that I would do all of these things at once because I like to work in chaos. Because if I'm only doing one thing, a lot of the time I will put that thing off and do other things. Like I will just like watch K-dramas or read, which are valid and amazing things to do. I highly recommend. So it was actually, those 2 years were very good for me because they were really productive in that I did do all my revisions for Rebel Soul in those 2 years and everything that goes along with debuting. And I also went to grad school and I worked on multiple projects. So grad school, I went to Lesley University's MFA program at Lesley in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And they have like great professors. My professors like Tracy Batiste, Susan Goodman, Michelle Knudsen, and also Jason Reynolds is there, Chris Lynch, and David Elliott. So I had a lot of really great people around me. And
that's amazing.
Yeah. And my cohort of students, so just like the other people in my program, but also we had, in our classes, we also took film classes. We also took creative writing, adult creative writing, creative nonfiction classes. Everyone was so supportive. So the residency is set up so that it's a low residency program. So you spend most of the time working at home, but you also go to Cambridge every twice a year for 9 days and you do like workshops. And so each time we had a residency submit pages, and a lot of the times people work on one project for 2 years or they work on two projects, but I actually did four different projects. Whoa. Because I wanted to try four different books. So I did, my first book was the one that I signed with my agent on, and that was a first person YA fantasy. And then the second book was in third person. I think the third book, and it was a horror. And then the third book was another fantasy, third person. It was historical. So I tried different things because I knew and worked with different mentors because I was trying to learn as much as possible. that was my goal. But as you said, at the same time I'm working, I was doing revisions with Rebel Soul at the time. And I was not allowed to work on that project at school because I had a talk with my mentor at the time, and she was like, that's a conflict of interest because you have to listen to your editor. You can't listen to me first, and you should listen to your teacher first in this program. And I was like, you're right. So I had to revise Rebel Soul at the same time as writing new work for the program. But it helped because I also wasn't working at the time, which is also why 100% I could do this, because I didn't have a full-time job. I was just tutoring part-time. So I definitely think that's the reason I could do this. But yes, so that's how I did the time management. I would prioritize pretty much whatever the deadline was first, came first. And I'm also a huge perfectionist, which is actually a flaw. I think that's a flaw where I can't hand in anything that I don't think is perfect. And I'm like trying to work on that because obviously nothing is ever perfect. And like that always means I'm always going to fail, right? If it has to be perfect, then I'm always failing. That's like a thing too, where every time I had, a deadline was coming up, I'd be really stressed out. But also I would time management in that I knew that that's what was coming up first. And that's what I feel also like so much shame if I handed something that I'm not proud of. Everything I always hand in, I always want to be able to stand behind. I think that's something that I will always be like that with anything I write, that I want to be able to be proud of what I write, which is also why I work on my craft so much, because I think there's like some famous quote somewhere that's like, the reason writing is so hard is because you have this belief in a book. You know what's good writing. You know what's a good story. And if your work doesn't reach that, it's so disheartening, or that's what kind of makes you block yourself, mm-hmm. I feel like. And I have that too, where I have so many idols that are writers, books I love. And when my work doesn't reach that sort of level, it really hinders my work. So I kind of have to work with that. I feel like that's something that a lot of people have, like a lot of people are that way. And it helps having critique partners who are critical, but also very encouraging. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks all of our mutual friends. You know what really struck out to me was that, because we've talked about this a lot, is the idea that you want to be very proud of any work you put out there, which I honestly believe is really important. And I understand that the industry takes a bajillion years for anything to happen. So sometimes you're like, oh my God, just let it be this manuscript that gets published. But sometimes I think that if that is your mindset, then you might rush into it with something that isn't ready or isn't in the place it needs to be. And I think on top of that, because we are people of color and because we are, all three of us, incorporate parts of our identity and our heritage into our writing, there's like an innate unspoken kind of responsibility in that. So I was wondering like how that relates to that feeling, because your books, both Rebel Soul and Rogue Heart, are in East Asian worlds with Asian leads, and obviously you're incorporating themes of history into it. So like, how did you kind of go about making sure that you're doing your due diligence?
Actually, this is something I want to talk about a little bit, but also like backtracking a bit. Like I told you that I began in narrative nonfiction, which is writing about yourself, right? So everything, when I first started writing, it was all, they're kind of like diary entries, but like written in a way that other people can read them, right? So I would write about my brother, I write about my sister, those sort of things. And that's kind of how I tapped into my childhood. And that's sort of how I tapped into the emotional part of writing, which I think is so important. So when I first started writing fiction, a lot of my book, because I started in narrative nonfiction, they have to really mean something to me personally. Like, I have to really care about something happening in the book. And so, like, with Rebel Soul, I really cared about Korean history. I really cared about that, like, the whole colonialism and all that kind of stuff that happened to Korea. And it really mattered to me. And I was watching a lot of, like, Kak Chital came out right before I wrote this book. And Kat can tell you, like, we were obsessed with this drama, but it's pretty much about a freedom fighter in Korea.
I love this drama so much.
And, you know, I just, when I was writing the book, because it was sci-fi, I think it had that little bit of, it had that distance where it didn't have to be completely, it's not historical, so I didn't have to do any of that sort of research, but the cultural research I had to do a lot of, because I'm Korean American. I was born in New York City. I was not born in Korean. I'm not fluent in Korean. So, like, all the language that I put in the book, I wanted it to be right. And I wanted to feel like, even though it's written in English, I wanted to feel like when you're reading it, that it could even be in Korean, which is, like, an interesting feeling I wanted to evoke. And by doing that, I used a lot of language, and I got a lot of readers to read it who weren't, I don't know, I guess they're sensitivity readers now. A lot of them are just, like, my mom's friends. Or, like, you know, my family friends, some of whom caught really interesting things I never thought of them. Like, one of them caught this, like, in the original book, in Rebel Soul, this Chaewon plays a game called Gonggi. It's, like, the game where you, like, you throw a rock and they catch them in your hand. You know this game?
I don't.
Oh, like where you turn your hand, you catch them on the back.
And Chaewon was saying, like, I used to play this with my Haemuni when I was young. And my reader was like, no, only girls played that. And I was like, oh, I would have never known that. And so I changed the game. Things like that, like little things like that where it's like, oh, that's so interesting. And, like, she said something like, at one point I had, like, the character has Saturi accent or something like that. And she goes, that doesn't make any sense. That's just saying accent. Because Saturi means accent. And I was like, it's like, that's true.
In chai tea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, thank you. That'd be so embarrassing if that made it in. Like, little things like that. Like, she wasn't even reading it to be a sensitivity reader. She just read it because she was like, send me your book. And I was like, sure. That kind of stuff. Little things like that, I'm glad I caught. Because there's things that, you know, not growing up. I guess that thing about, like, you can't tell you if you're fluent if you can tell a joke in a different language. Like, I can't tell. The only joke I can tell is, like, Konglish jokes in Korean. What's, like, a vampire's favorite drink? And it's, like, kopi. Just, like, nose.
Oh.
Nosebleeding. Korean.
Ew.
It means a nosebleed, but it also, like, could be a drink.
Coffee. Yeah. So Konglish jokes are in my realm, but not, like, jokes in Korean. That was, like, the thing I cared most about before my book came out, was really getting all of those things right, because I know as a Korean reader how critical I am of other Korean writers. And so, I mean, not critical, but, like, I'm better now. 100% better now because I'm a writer and I know what it's like. But when I was younger, if I read anything that was, like, Korean, I really, really, really wanted to relate so hard to whatever it was written. I would want to relate so hard to the characters. And when they don't relate to me, I would feel so hurt. And so, like, with that in the back of my head, this was, what, 2014 when I was actually writing this book, I really wanted it to be relatable to the kind of Korean American that I am. So that really mattered to me, and getting everything right. And when I first started writing too, I had a lot of people were, like, very skeptical, because they're like, well, they're all immigrants, right? They're all born in Korea and they came over here. So they're like, how would you know what it's like to grow up and, like, have a character that's Korean kind of thing? I proved them all wrong, but they were all very skeptical at first. Because they were worried.
It's because, like, I think that when you're in the community, you know how critical the community can be, because we want each other to do the best. Because I have a theory that it is because, like, for a person of color, especially for an immigrant, to be taken seriously, you have to be three times as good as your white counterparts, right? So they're like, their worry for us comes from that, but they're not saying that. Like, so we're like, why are you being so critical of me? But really, it's because they grew up suffering through this like harsh judgment, and they want us to be better prepared for it.
A lot of it comes from fear for your sake, not like you can't do this, you're not capable. It's more like, oh, but if you do it wrong, all these people are going to say these terrible things about you, and I'm really worried about you. Or like, don't disappoint our people.
I think it's a healthy dose of both.
Yeah, it's like anything happens to like a Korean person like on TV, my parents are like proud as if it's like their family. Like, okay. But I also have that too. Like, Sandra Oh does anything well, I'm like, yeah. Also, I'm not related to her.
No.
Just so everyone knows. I'm also not related to LNO, just so everyone knows.
Yeah. Axie's not related to any famous Oh.
Only a famous Cho.
Oh my gosh.
I'm related to John Cho.
I'm related to the people who make Ortega tacos.
Are you really?
No.
Podcast episode of lies. This podcast is Axie O and every single lie. You know what my newest thing, my newest version of that is now? It's when I see other Korean people, like Korean American people that I follow on Twitter, when I see them in Korea, like, oh, I'm on, like, Jenny Han's in Korea right now.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Like, I feel like I'm there with her. I'm like, oh, Jenny and I went to this, like, Kyobo Books today.
Okay, that's the thing, though. Like, this is how I felt before debut. This is how I felt like 2014 when I was starting. Now I'm like, anyone who's like writes Korean books, I'm like, oh, I'm so excited. I'm going to support you 100%. And I also think that's because of the changing atmosphere too. Like, I feel like I'm learning from other people being brave about their work and like everyone accepting Asian representation and thinking it's cool. It makes me be like, oh, okay. It's okay to think these things are cool now. I mean, I always did. But I mean, like, being public about it and all that kind of stuff, like, it's not a weird thing anymore. It's not, like, a nerd thing to be like, I love Gundam. Or I love K-pop. That's not, like, a weird thing anymore. Like, that was when I was 11. I loved Finkel.
Oh, yeah, you did.
I had a whole poster board of just, like, these are, like, older K-pop people. They're, like, Finkel, H.O.T., G.O.D. They're all, like, which generation was that? I don't know. It was like first generation K-pop.
Yeah.
I had no one to share my love with except like Kat and like Jennifer and my other cousin.
Loved H.O.T.
Yeah.
Jennifer loved H.O.T., but you are the one who introduced us to G.O.D.
I love G.O.D. Well, G.O.D., my brother loved G.O.D. I was more a Finkel fan and SES. I love my girl group. I love them so much.
Back in our day, people would make fun of us for liking K-pop. Like, I remember, because I really like, I didn't like a lot of groups, but I really liked H.O.T. Because in high school, my sister liked H.O.T. and I wanted to be just like her. So when I was like a freshman in high school, I listened to them all the time. And people would make fun of me for listening to this like Korean bubblegum pop.
Yeah.
No, you know what I was thinking though, going back to what you said, like when you were younger and you were reading books with the Korean experience and you really, really wanted it to relate to your experience. I mean, I think now we know better, like that no experience is universal. But I do think that back in the day, especially when we were younger and there weren't as many like Asian Korean diverse authors being published, it was kind of, I think it came from like a thing of like, maybe this is all I'll ever get, like that kind of a feeling and desperately wanting it to represent you because it's literally all you think you'll ever get. And because I remember thinking that too. I remember like actively being like, not even with just Korean things, but like Asian in general, I really wanted anything Asian in media to like somehow be my representative, because I didn't know if I'd ever get it, the chance again.
For sure. Like any like Yellow Power Ranger.
Oh my God, I love the Yellow Power Ranger. Yeah.
I mean, like we talked about this growing up. We also watched a lot of anime. So we, in a way, we're like found our Asian. It was nerd-y, but we attempted to find Asian representation, but it wasn't mainstream. But in mainstream media, anytime there was an Asian, like, I really liked Cho Chang because I actually everyone grew up reading Harry Potter. The books came out the year that, like, when the fourth book came out, I was 14. When the fifth book came out, I was 15. Like, and so I really, really liked Cho Chang, which is interesting. I mean, now I probably have, like, all these thoughts. But back then I was like, I'm glad the Asian girl is, like, pretty and, like, people like her. Sure, she has two last names, but that's fine.
I remember that, actually. I agree. When Cho Chang first showed up on the page, I actively remember thinking, oh, she has my name. It's Cho. And I was like, I'll root for her because one of her names is Cho, even though yeah. they're both, you know, last names.
Yeah.
And that's inaccurate. Like, yeah. I was like, I feel like it's my duty as a Cho to root for Cho Chang.
Yeah. Anytime an Asian person showed up in anything, I would either root for them or like be highly critical of them. It was like one or the other. But not anymore.
Now we're better.
So Axie, Rogue Heart is out October 8th, which will already be passed by the time this episode airs. But do you want to tell our listeners what it's about?
Yeah, so Rogue Heart is a companion to Rebel Soul, and it follows a character who was a side character in the first book. She's a telepath. It's 2 years after the events of the first book, in which there's like some terrible stuff happened, and she was betrayed and all this kind of good stuff. And then she's sort of hiding in Beijing, New Beijing, as a bakery store attendant, but also moonlights as a singer because I needed to have that whole K-pop aesthetic. What happens is she gets recruited into an organization that's trying to take down the government, the totalitarian government. So she's going, it's sort of like a noir crime adventure story with giant robots, because you need to have giant robots. So she's going on this sort of mission across this mission across Asia to doing like little missions here and there to stop the, you know, doing little missions, infiltration, those sort of things. And then her last mission is to pose as an officer in a base of the boy who broke her heart in the first book. But because she's a telepath, she can make it so he doesn't recognize her. So she's she's undercover agent in his base trying to take him down, sort of thing. So it's like very fun, lots of action, lots of romance. It comes out October 8th, Rogue Heart.
Yay! Yay! Sounds amazing. And we'll make sure to put all the links in the show notes. Everybody go buy the customary 20 copies. Actually, so everybody who's on the show either shares their most embarrassing publishing moment or something they wish they'd known before they started. So you can pick either or. You can pick both of them. It's up to you.
Well, my whole life is embarrassing, so I guess I'll pick the other one. I guess we were talking a little bit about this earlier, but I think that belief that publishing will go one way, because I always thought publishing would go one way, because that's just how I actually didn't know how publishing would go at all, because I had no idea. But just understanding that it could, so many different things could happen in your career, and they're all good and they're all fine. And you shouldn't think that it has to be one way or the highway. It's better to think it could be all these different ways. Like, you could write novels. You could write in one genre. You could write multiple genres. You can write short fiction. You can write things that never get published. You can write things that you just put on your website because you want to, because it's fun to share your work. And just remember that writing, you went into writing not necessarily to get published, although that's great. You went into writing because you love to write, right? So I feel like that's something that I would have told myself. I would tell myself, because I felt like for a lot of my publishing life, I thought it had to be one way. And then I'm always constantly surprised when it's not. That's not a bad thing, but it's like I'm like constantly being surprised or constantly being like, no, you were wrong. And that feeling of like, you're wrong is kind of like, oh, I guess that's fine. But also like, ugh, I wish I was right for once. That it won't go the way you expect it to go, but you'll still be fine. I'm just copying what my fortune said. When I went to Japan, I did one of those like Shinto shrine fortunes. And literally that's what it said. It said for career, it said it won't go the way you thought it would, but you'll be fine. Something like that.
Oh, wow.
Well, that's, and I was like, well, thanks, Shinto Shrine.
That reminds me of our critique partner, Christine Lynn Herman, wrote Devouring Grey, out now, that she does tarot readings, and her tarot readings are weirdly accurate, like so specific that you're like, it's very possible this won't happen because it's so specific, and it 100% happens.
Yes.
Because Christine's a witch.
Yeah, that's like, why I don't.
It's the only explanation.
That's why I don't want her to tarot card readings for me, because I'm 100% super believe in that, and I'm super superstitious. Like, I'm very superstitious. Yeah. I inherited from that. I'm from double superstitious grandmas.
Yeah, you are.
Axie, thank you so much for being on the show. We really loved having you on, and we're so excited for all your books to come.
Yeah.
Thank you. I love you guys.
Yay!
I'm very proud of you. I'm very proud of all that I've taught you.
Thank you, Annie. Yeah.
Can you tell our listeners where they can find you on the interwebs?
Axio.com. Also, appropriate links on the website.
Okay, and we'll link all your social media below as well. Thanks, Axie.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Write or Die. Make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a review, and while you're at it, be sure to pick up Wicked Fox by me, Kat Cho, and Ghost Squad by Claribel A. Ortega.
See you next time, Wordies.
And don't forget to spread the word.